guest is the spokesman, the national spokesman for Republican congressional candidate, Congressman Ron Paul. And our guest is Bruce Fein, his spokesman. Mr. Fein, a graduate of Harvard Law School, served as an associate deputy attorney and attorney general and general counsel to the FCC under President Ronald Reagan. His particular expertise is in the area of constitutional law, and he's the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy, and also American Empire Before the Fall. Mr. Fein, thanks very much for joining us on In Context. Can you hear me now? Hello, Mr. Fein, are you there?
It seems like there are some glitches going on with the equipment right now. Just bear with us for a second when we get that worked out. We have studio extraordinaire Steve DeCostanza here helping us out.
Oh, okay, Mr. Fein, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. I hope you heard our introduction. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Condovero, the co-host of In Context, and March McDermott Rowe is handling our board today. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. I think that you may have, and it's clearly understandable, misspoke when you described Ron Paul as a congressional candidate.
I'm sorry. Congressman Ron Paul, who is a presidential candidate, and that's an important correction.
Of course.
For the Republican nomination. And we wanted to start the show. We want to examine for our listeners some of Congressman Paul's principal issues in the race, and then open the phone line to people who would like to talk to you, Mr. Fein, about those issues. So we'll be giving out our phone number shortly, and those who have questions, who would like to email us, or with their questions or comments, should send them to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. Now, Mr. Fein, Congressman Paul is the first and perhaps the only candidate for the Republican nomination who's put out a very detailed map of where he wants the federal budget to go. And in his budget proposal, he says he's going to balance the budget in 4 years, and he's going to cut $1 trillion a year. And a lot of these budget proposals that people hear about state $1 trillion in cumulative terms. They'll say 10 years and we'll cut $1 trillion. But Congressman Paul is going to end up doing in 1 year. Could you talk about how Congressman Paul gets from here to there with the federal budget?
Yes, and let's begin with the largest element, I think, that can be cut, in fact, strengthen the security of the United States. That's the current $1.2 trillion we expend on a national security issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
$1.2 trillion, that's more spending than the combined defense budgets of the entire world combined. So that is totally unnecessary because his defense platform is different than all other candidates for the Republican nomination as well as President Obama. It can be stated very simply in an echo of the Founding Fathers. Millions for defense, not 1 cent for empire. We are spending staggering sums. For example, $120, $130 billion in Afghanistan or $350 million a day for fighting maybe 50 Al-Qaeda. Totally for Al-Qaeda are terrible criminals. We need to defend against that. We do not need to declare a war with that extravagant spending, 100,000 troops there. And I want your audience to think about this comparison. If the troop-to-enemy ratio that now obtains for the United States in Afghanistan were employed in World War II in fighting the far more sophisticated and potent Japanese and German armies, we would have fielded a armed force of 3.5 billion, meaning we would have had to multiply the entire population by 126 even to get there if we were to conscript everyone. That's an example of what Congressman Paul recognized, this empire mentality, which seeks to have a risk-free existence. The tiniest threat then causes the United States to declare de facto or de jure war and expend vast sums that could be better spent defending Americans back here in the United States. Say, that's a staggering sum just in Afghanistan. Think, $350 million this very day.
Mm-hmm.
For what? How many people get up worrying that someone out of a cave in Afghanistan is going to come and attack them?
No,
it doesn't mean we're not Pollyannish. We understand there are evil things out there, but evil things domestically, too. Timothy McVeigh, there's 17,000 murders each year. We need to be on our guard. We need to use intelligence, but we need to be involved in defense. preemptive warfare is the antonym of defense. It is a formula for never-ending spending that's going to bankrupt us and keeps creating enemies, because when you're involved in this kind of open-ended warfare, civilians inevitably are going to be killed, and that's going to create great resentment against the United States.
Now, Mr. I just want to interrupt you quickly. You're certainly on a roll, but we have a list of topics we wanted to get through, and we're sort of jumping around, but they are all interconnected, and that's why the Ron Paul candidacy is so monumental and important, because it's the only one that really gets to the root of all of the problems, which you can all be linked to an economic standpoint. Now, you're talking about the terrorism, and people have a far greater chance of dying from bee stings or drowning in bathtubs car crashes. But our reaction to this one thing of terrorism, because it's just so scary, is just so incredibly disproportionate, especially with the cost that we place on this actually really low risk. Now, I know that the one major attack that everyone points to is 9/11. We don't want another 9/11. And that was a disastrous economic loss and loss of life on one day. And that's why it resonates so strongly with people, and why it's such a great, I don't use the word great, but such a tremendous sticking point for the defense industry. They used it as the calling card, And how realistic is the mantra where we say we fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here? How realistic is it that Al-Qaeda is going to launch an invasion of the United States and actually bring us to our knees if we were to withdraw within our borders and not have an interventionist foreign policy?
Well, I think the likelihood is zero. Mm. And remember, I'm not trying to defend those murders who perpetrated 9/11.
Of course not.
It's an abomination. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, even if it's not exculpatory, if the United States did not have 1,000 bases abroad, mm-hmm. intervening in every domestic situation, whether propping up Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the Shah of Iran, all these other countries, mm-hmm. There wouldn't have been resentment. It may be true that we weren't killing anybody directly, but we were supporting regimes that created enormous resentment in their citizenry. Because those regimes are autocratic. They're hardly democratic.
So you're saying that they don't hate us for our freedom.
We could see that the tanks and the tear gas in the streets of Cairo, made in America. So that creates an anger. Now, even with that, and the dastardly attacks of 9/11, Al-Qaeda never had the ability to occupy the United States, to threaten our sovereignty. They're very evil people, and when they commit crimes, we capture them, we try them, we sentence them, and even if we can impose a death penalty, as was a potential for Mr. Zacharias Moussaoui, he was the 20th hijacker, and we can, as the Israelis did to Adolf Eichmann, exercise kidnapping abroad, bring them back here for due process trials, but that is not war. War is very different than criminal law enforcement, because it means the law is silent. It means the spending becomes extravagant. It means that you have indiscriminate killing, because the idea is, well, you make mistakes in war, and if you're innocent, then you're collateral damage. That's why it's so important to raise the threshold, very exacting standard, before you enter that twilight zone of life.
Mm.
If you take even the $1.2 trillion that we're spending, it's not that we stop spending. We could probably spend a third of that, bring our troops back to defend the United States. If we're not there, it's ridiculous in my mind to think that Al-Qaeda members wake up furious that we have a freedom in the United States, that what really makes them angry is to see a free press, free radio, to see elections being held, to see men and women on buses or on metros together, and that's what creates their great anger. That just defies reality. That's not crazy.
Now, Mr. Fine,
the resentment.
There's been a lot of talk in the press in the last few days about a possible war with Iran over its nuclear program. What's Congressman Paul's position on Iran?
Iran, we should not be imposing. The best way and to reduce the incentive for them to develop a nuclear weapon is to stay out of their business. We tried earlier, remember, we overthrew Mossadegh, the first Democratic elected prime minister in Iran.
1953.
We ended up with the Shah and then the Ayatollah. Mm-hmm. So our track record there isn't very good. Right. We obviously do not cherish nuclear proliferation. But the fact is, we have been able, and we lived with it, with the Soviet Union. Russia's got nuclear weapons. China has nuclear weapons. North Korea, as erratic as their rulers are, have nuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. India has got nuclear weapons.
Right.
Israel has nuclear weapons.
Right, right.
So we do not favor nuclear weapons, but we would never go to war offensively for that purpose. Obviously, we would use a deterrent. You know, you strike us, we will incinerate you. Right. The deterrent worked and has worked throughout the Cold War and post-Cold War period. And I think it's ridiculous to think that these people in Iran are different, made of different DNA, even worse than North Korea, and suddenly would commit suicide by trying to attack the United States,
right,
knowing we would incinerate them.
Mr. Fine,
even with the scope of the Soviet Union, they flinched over the Cuban Missile Crisis. They didn't cherish it. And I don't. There's no evidence to suggest that the Iranians have any other a quest for self-preservation than other countries.
Well, Mr. Fine, a related question. Oh, go ahead. Marchand, did you have a question for Mr. Fine?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I mean, I think you make a very valid point. I mean, somehow a man who wears welder glasses and bouffant hairdo and high heels somehow frightens me just a little bit more than Iran, which seems to be an up-and-coming developing country.
And moreover, has a history of culture, Cyrus the Great, Darius, great poets and whatever. And they negotiated with us over the release of our hostages in the embassy. You know, they didn't crave, you know, committing Harry Carey or anything like that. You know, they have negotiated like any other power, you know, that's not sentimental. They don't respond to morality, but what other countries do? You know, this is real politique. And if we make it clear, we will destroy them if they ever attempted any kind of nuclear program against us. There's no reason to think they'd respond differently than countries with far more formidable nuclear arsenals, including the Soviet Union under Stalin, over Berlin or otherwise. That would suggest that deterrence won't work.
If you just tuned in, we're talking with Bruce Fine, spokesman for presidential candidate Ron Paul. The name of our show is In Context, and we're taking your calls at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to speak with Congressman Paul's spokesman, Bruce Fine.
Now, Mr. Fine, I know that you are an expert on the law. You're a constitutional scholar. Now, I wanted to use a parallel subject here and talk about the Patriot Act, torture, habeas corpus, rendition, secret courts. This has been a very big topic in the past 10 years since 9/11, the launches of the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq, all of our excursions around the Middle East and North Africa. You know, we've had very questionable interactions and gray areas in the law where we're now picking up American citizens and whisking them away to these, you know, unknown black sites to be questioned, you know, with no end in sight. People cannot even see the evidence against them to defend themselves. And obviously the possibilities of where this could lead is just down an endless black hole of just a hellhole situation where none of us want to go, completely un-American. And I hear Ron Paul talk about this a lot, and I think, you know, I'm of the mindset, justice be done, may the heavens fall. And if we don't follow the rule of law, what are we?
Yeah, we've destroyed our reason for being. I think you're exactly right. If anything, you've understated it because you omitted the greatest tyranny that's ever been invented by the mind of man, the authority of one person to kill a citizen based upon secret facts and secret law.
Of course,
namely,
we've talked
Mr.
about
Al-Laki
it here.
Yes. Over in Yemen, a few
yes.
days later, followed by killing his son with a predator drone, and the government remained silent on that score. But can you define tyranny in any more absolute way than crowning someone with authority to kill a citizen on secret facts and secret law? You can't go beyond that. But you know, presidential candidate Paul has opposed the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
We have now the President of the United States, through a spokesman, telling the U.S. Supreme Court that the government has authority to track you, me, the Supreme Court justices, everybody in the United States, 24 hours a day, wherever we move, 365 days a year, with no suspicion at all that we're engaged in any kind of wrongful conduct, 24 hours a day. I mean, that's the definition of 1984.
Clearly.
The Ministry of Truth. I mean, Winston is already here. You know, and Ron Paul has been very eloquent in speaking out against these mindless efforts to destroy the greatest liberty known to mankind, the right to be left alone.
Now, clearly we have a situation being set up where Mr. Fine, you still there?
Yes,
I am. I'm sorry. Okay. We have a situation being set up where you are, everybody, guilty till proven innocent, and the burden of proof is put on us. You know, you have municipalities going through your trash trying to see if you're following the law. You know, there is just absolutely no end to where this end in sight, and this can only proceed. And the only thing that I have to say is, are we any safer? I submit that we're not. You know, 50 years ago, this country was far more organized and lawful and moral, and we've gone down this rabbit hole with no end in sight where they just continue to snoop and prod us to try to get more information out of us. Now, with the internet, you know, Google just willingly gives up whatever information the FBI wants without even a question. And you know, where does it end?
No, well, I agree with you on two points. First of all, it certainly all this information, the vacuum cleaned information, doesn't make us safer. In fact, it creates so much of a haystack that you can never find the needle, since you're totally indiscriminate in what you gather. But equally important is the fact that our greatest safety lies in a citizenry that loves and trusts its government and people, that come forth voluntarily, like was done with Richard Reed and stopping him on his effort to blow up an airliner, or those who would thwarted Mr. Abdul Muttalib out in Detroit. And you do not create loyalty in your citizenry by accusing them of being guilty of treason or being a terrorist until they've been cleared.
Right,
what you say is the presumption of guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking with Mr. Bruce Fine.
Even though we now have an intelligence industry that, in the government, that expends about $100 billion annually producing tens of thousands of reports or whatever, the end users say this is useless. It's never foiled a single terrorist plot directly. And that's what was shown even with regard to the Inspector General's examination of what happened with the terrorist surveillance program. None of these are warrantless interceptions of our emails and phone calls by the National Security Agency flouting the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Where does it get us? When everything is significant, then nothing is significant. But it goes back to your more fundamental point. In the United States, it was formed on the idea that the individual and liberty was the center of our constitutional universe, that government was there to secure our liberties, not to invade them. And that if there was ever any deed, we don't have to make enough justification for our right to be left alone, for our right to liberty. It's ours because we're born. It's the government that has the burden of showing some compelling need to come invade our privacy.
Excuse me,
and
Mr.
That's
Fine.
Turned on its head now.
We have some calls for you.
The drop of a hat.
Excuse me, Mr. Fine. I think we have some listeners who'd like to speak with you.
Go ahead, Mr. Costello.
Yes, my name is Bill Costello. I'm part of the Ridgefield Liberty Cooperative, and we're actually having an event on 12-1. At Town Hall, who is Ron Paul. So I am a supporter. But my concern really is that number one issue in the United States is jobs. And I think people have a hard time understanding how all of the talk and foreign policy and spending, how it relates to jobs in the United States.
Thank you very much for the call.
The connection is rather direct, and that is, if you have the government budget slashed by $500 to $1 trillion by this excessive waste that's used to build an empire rather than to defend the United States where we should be defending, that creates an enormous amount of capital that instead of going in to paying foreign governments for their military bases or whatever,
is
now saved. And that capital is now available for small businesses to start up companies. And that's certainly a very, very direct impact between our national security budget and jobs. On the other hand, I will, if you wish me to go on and explain how Ron Paul is not limiting himself to the defense element, the national security portion of the budget in order to save money and to spark jobs. He clearly wants to cut much of the domestic spending, too.
We'll get into that one moment, Mr. Fine. I think we have another caller who would like to speak with you.
Don from Maine.
Hello, Don. You're on the air, WPKN, In Context. What's your question for Mr. Fine?
First of all, I want to know what his opinion is of neoconservatism that Ron Paul has attacked in two of his books. And also, I want to know, he used that quote about millions for defense, not one penny for empire. I think the word is tribute.
Well, that was just variation. We have put it was on Robert Goodloe Harper's statement made several hundred, 200 years ago. But this is he wouldn't have used the word empire then because we didn't have an empire and we were not created to make an empire. So it's a variation on those words. That you're correct, that's the original quote, but we've used the beginning point but changed the end point because we've migrated from being a republic to an empire. Now, with regard to the neocons, they are exactly the epitome of this psychology of empire that believes that our goal is to dominate the whole world and to make the entire world in our image, the opposite of what the Founding Fathers and the Constitution was conceived about. The greatest expression of our philosophy as a government was John Quincy Adams, then Secretary of State, July 4th, 1821, addressed to Congress. He said, "We do not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy." Up to that time, it had been about 50 years since the forming of the Republic. We wish liberty well abroad, but we fight only for our own. And he went on to explain, we could be dictators of the world, but we would destroy the Republic in the process. That the glory of a Republic is liberty. The glory of an empire is domination, and we have chosen liberty. And that's basically the philosophy that the neocons have defiled, they've blasphemed, they've warped, and chosen the philosophy of empire, that we need to be all around the world and get some thrill out of making certain no other country becomes a military superpower. Mm. Well, listen, we are human beings like everyone else. We never celebrate anybody else's oppression, but we only fight for our own liberty and freedom. And that's for a good reason, not because we're callous, but because the projection of military force abroad necessarily destroys our institutions for liberty at home. The power, the secrecy, all migrates to the executive branch. The rule of law goes out the window. Everything is subordinated to a national security claim. And the Founding Fathers and the Constitution says, hey, that game isn't worth it. We would like to have our influence abroad by example to be powerful. But if it doesn't, that's for other people to fight for their liberty, not the United States of America, using United States military personnel and resources.
Great caller. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you so much for your question. Outstanding.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to an interview with Bruce Fine. He is the spokesman for presidential candidate Ron Paul. And I just wanted to relay an email question to you, Mr. Fine. This comes from Melissa in Connecticut, and she has a question about special interest groups. And she says, what would Ron Paul do to diminish the power of the special interest groups and lobbyists that have a stranglehold on Washington?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. All the questions are excellent. I want to applaud you and your audience for becoming involved citizens at the outset. And
we have the smartest audience in Connecticut.
I just want to make clear this is what real democracy is about. Hmm. Now, what about the special interest? The reason why the special interests have arisen is because the government is involved in too many places. With all these ridiculous government programs, we're the biggest landlord in the country. You know, we're trying to be the innovators, the Bill Gateses and the Steve Jobs by giving money to Solyndra and any other group, whether it's solar panels one day or coal gasification the next day. If the government got out of all of these enterprises where it's now spending, you know, trillions of dollars, the special interest groups would go away because there's nothing in it for them anyway to then lobby because the government doesn't get there. And he would apply strictly the Constitution as it was meant by the Founding Fathers, which was, yeah, the government is a government of limited authority. The states have all the authority outside those uniquely federal issues like a defense, like immigration, like a post office and telecommunications, and that kind of thing, owing money. But otherwise, the special interests would go away without the growth of government subsidies and spending. Because just think of this. If we move back into our history, you know, 100 years ago, we didn't have these debates about special interest money. Government wasn't in these issues, so it was ridiculous. Why would no one lobbies just for the sake of lobby, you know, to spend vast sums of money on $200 meetings unless they feel that they can get a monetary return on it.
Now, along those lines, I just...
Paul would do that by cutting budget agencies and spending.
Along those lines, I wanted to say that it's self-evident by the fact that there hasn't been any special interest money donated to the Ron Paul campaign. It's coming in mostly $40 donations, and I think I heard that the U.S. Army is one of the biggest employers of the donors. Is that true?
Yes, the military is some of the greatest donors to the campaign. But you're exactly right, and Ron is not soliciting no fat cat dinners where you pay $30,000, $40,000,
right.
$50,000 to come in and get a seat at the table.
Exactly.
You just joined us.
The special interests fear Ron Paul, and because they know that there's no bargaining with him, that he's not in there for the glory he wants to vindicate and honor the Constitution as it was crafted and for which so many have risked and given that last full measure of devotion. That's what he's about, ideas, right. Not egomania.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN, and we're speaking with Mr. Bruce Fein, who's a spokesman for presidential candidate Ron Paul. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or if you prefer to write, send us an email to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question or comment on the air.
Now, Mr. Fein, I have another question for you. I would like to talk a little bit. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I've heard Ron Paul talk a lot about executive orders and how, you know, signing statements and how the growth of the executive office has completely surpassed what the Constitution intends the office to be. Would Ron Paul repeal past executive orders that have granted future presidents excessive power?
Well, we examine the executive orders on a case-by-case basis, but one thing I can guarantee you, he would not be issuing executive orders to substitute or bypass the treaty obligation, which is done regularly with regard to troop deployments and stationing abroad.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our situation in right now turns on an executive agreement negotiated by then President Bush and ratified and continued on by President Obama. But certainly Ron Paul is one who would want to insist that Congress make the authorities and make the decisions that the Constitution fastens on them. And one of the most important is the decision whether or not to go to war. That now has a provision. It's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, if any of your audience wants to read it. Mm-hmm. The Founding Fathers were unanimous that they would entrust the decision to move from a state of peace to a state of war, a very, very important Rubicon to cross, because in times of war, the law is silent, only to the Congress, because all the Founding Fathers recognized the executive branch has an incentive to concoct excuses of war, because during wartime, the glory, the power, the money, the secrecy, the footprints in the sands of time, they all go to the executive. And the entire history of the world has been history of executives going to war for personal vanity,
right,
for petty insults or things of that sort. So they said only Congress can authorize the use of the military for offensive purposes. For example, when President Thomas Jefferson fought the Barbary Pirates, he had 10 statutes authorizing what he was doing. When James Madison had the War of 1812, that was something that was authorized, specifically directed by the Congress of the United States. But now we're in a situation where the president goes to war unilaterally. The president decided that he would unilaterally wage war in Libya. He didn't receive any congressional authority. He said he didn't even need to report to Congress because it wasn't hostilities in Libya, since we didn't have pilots endangered of being shut down, which, as I pointed out at the time, would mean that we could have launched nuclear weapons from the United States with ICBMs and destroyed every living thing in Libya and not engage in, quote, hostilities in the president's eyes, because we didn't risk a pilot in destroying everything with nuclear weapons.
Right.
It was utterly a mindless and very dangerous concept of hostilities.
Right. Excuse me, Mr. Fein, I think we have another.
To go to war, and President Paul would say, it's not up to me. Congress has got to make that decision. And even when we're debating issues about invading Iran, it's never, well, would Congress go in there and authorize it? We're asking the president, you know, presidential candidates, well, would you go in unilaterally, you know?
We've forgotten
anyway.
Who's supposed
why
to be in charge.
Ask the question? You should be asking that of the House and Senate of the United States.
That's right. I believe we have another caller for you, Mr. Fein. Do we not, Marshawn?
This is Stefan from Bridgewater.
Stefan,
go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Stefan. You're on the air. Thanks for calling. Do you have a question
for
Mr. Fein?
Like this. My question is this. Is the media blackout of Ron Paul going to be as big this year as it was 4 years ago? I mean, I was just disgusted at what a media blackout went on.
I have some stats here to back that up. Yeah, let's hear your answer, Mr. Fein.
I mean, I just want to say, do you remember when Ron Paul was debating against Rudy Giuliani, and he said something about the fact that we're hated over there? And
yeah.
Palmer Johnson can corroborate that with Blowback, the book Blowback.
Yeah.
And what happened? Giuliani just shouted him down, and Giuliani gets a standing applause. Like, come on.
But Mr. Fine, before you answer that, I just want to back up this up with some stats because I took the time to put in a little graph for myself, so I'm proud of it. and the times during the last debates, the average, Romney gets 11.91 minutes, Perry 11.03 minutes, Bachman 7.32, Gingrich 7, Huntsman 7, Kane 6, Santorum 6, Ron Paul only 6.5 minutes average time. And in the last debate, he had 90 seconds, but yet his average poll numbers stay steady at 10%, while everybody has dropped down to 1% when they have had time up in 10, 15, 20%, like Bachman, and you know Santorum doesn't even register. What do you have to say about that?
It's true that media has attempted, maybe it's not a complete blackout, but certainly maybe it rises to the level of chiaroscuro, a little bit of gray at times. But it's because the media itself, in my judgment, is complicit in this empire mentality. They just don't know how to deal with a candidate who really believes in a republic, because the media also is involved in big government and promoting the idea that the United States has got to be the most powerful country in the world, that that goes abroad like Julius Caesar, Veni, Vidi, Vici, and things of that sort. So they don't want to give credence to his ideas because in their mind it's outside their mainstream, if you want to put it, neocon thinking.
Do you have an opinion?
It's been grossly unfair because
you're absolutely right.
In comparison to his popular support, you know, the media as a proxy is about, you know, 1/100 of his support in the electorate.
That's right. Stefan, thanks so much for that phone call.
I just want to add, Mr. Fine, do you have an opinion on the leaked email that the Bachman campaign said that she received accidentally that showed collusion, that they were definitely not going to give her many questions, and I'm sure that the same email was sent about Ron Paul. Do you think that this shows a broader issue where the networks are clearly trying to control the question flow of the debates?
Yes, I have no doubt. The idea that media people somehow are platonic guardians that are searching for truth without ulterior motives is ridiculous. They're human beings with prejudices and biases like everyone else. And they clearly want to be there, and part of their own thrill or sense of importance is, yeah, we get to decide, you know, who's going to win and who's not by who we want to favor for this particular time and place.
Right, and the sad thing is that most people don't watch the debates. I was talking to someone yesterday. I said, did you watch the debates? I said, no, I read about the debates. Okay, well, if you read about the debates, it's clearly going to be some kind of contrived...
Guys, people pay a price for not paying attention.
I know.
And now they're paying a price in terms of millions of lost jobs, in terms of this horrendous bank bailout,
yeah,
and these ridiculous wars all over the world.
Sometimes I feel like you and I are the only ones who care.
Well, our listeners care, and I think we have another listener who would like to speak to Mr. Fine. Right now.
Yes, this is Barbara from Richfield. Go ahead, Barbara.
Thanks for
you're
calling,
on the air.
Barbara.
Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I was going to ask a question about the media blackout, but then that has just been said.
Uh-huh.
Also, in relation to the media blackout, there's the polls that are taken post-debate. And Ron Paul always wins by tremendous percentages,
good point.
And then the media takes them down immediately. And my question really is, in regards to this, how do we get around this? Maybe the other caller just said this, but Ron Paul is doing very well in Iowa and New Hampshire. How do we get that word out that he is viable and that the media's drumbeat, he'll never win, is a bunch of malarkey? So what do we do?
Well, thank you very much for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara.
There, I think we have an excellent social media outlets that we can utilize. It's not like it was, you know, 30 years ago where you had three networks and that was about it. So there are ways in which the clout of the mainstream media, if you will, has been diminished. And moreover, there are oftentimes people who recognize that there's a blackout and will vote against the media in resentment. I mean, remember, Harry Truman lost to Tom Dewey in 1948 until he won, even though everybody was predicting that he had already lost. And we think that there's a very high likelihood that Ron can prevail in Iowa and New Hampshire, despite the effort to try to minimize his popularity there in the media. And that will be something that's undeniable. You can't take away the votes at the ballot. And it's like the caller maybe tacitly is recognizing when Ron placed second out in Iowa, just a nudge, I think, behind Blackman, That was very close.
Yeah, there's like she was giving out free tickets, if I recall.
200 vote difference, I think it was.
Yeah, I think she was giving out free tickets to an event at which you had pretty much the quid pro quo was if you go into the event, you're going to vote for her.
And I think the irony of it was that she only got half the votes she paid for.
Democracy at its best.
She wasn't paying quite as much as Bloomberg pays his votes.
You're listening to In Context.
I do think that there will be a huge surprise there, in the mainstream media when the results in Iowa are taken.
If you'd like to join the conversation with Mr. Bruce Fein, who is Ron Paul's spokesman, give us a call here at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. And one subject that Ron Paul stands out on is the Federal Reserve, the whole money question. He's addressed it in a way that I don't think any other candidate, in either party, with possible exception of Dennis Kucinich. Could you talk about Ron Paul's attitude towards the Federal Reserve and how he would like to see, what changes he would like to see?
Yes. We need to start with a little background. The United States flourished economically for 100 and some years without a Federal Reserve system at all. It wasn't even born until 1913. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you need a Federal Reserve system in order to have economically a flourishing country is inaccurate. And moreover, the Federal Reserve system now with the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, it basically is involved in price fixing. It tries to fix interest rates by controlling or manipulating the money supply. One day it may vote, well, we now have $600 billion more dollars or $1 trillion that we'll create simply by buying or selling Treasury securities with dollars that it orders to be printed by the United States Mint. And in fixing the interest rates, when they tried to fix it at very low a couple of years ago, it was the Fed that fueled the so-called subprime market. Remember, everybody thought that housing prices would go up forever, and that you were taking no risk because even if there were defaults, the price of the house would be far more than when it was initially purchased. And people were buying houses with the expectation that the bubble would never pop. And that was something fueled by the Federal Reserve System. If we didn't have the Fed fixing interest rates, but interest rates responded to the true supply and demand for money, we wouldn't have a bubble-like economy.
Who would control
Ron Paul? Ron Paul would simply ultimately phase out the Federal Reserve System. There's no reason why you need a central bank. Countries and regions like Hong Kong have flourished for decades without a central bank whatsoever, and that if you move to a gold system, you wouldn't have politicians manipulating the money supply to try to push the economy too fast where it shouldn't be going. It's the equivalent in a different way of Solyndra. The government believing it's smarter than can outfox the free market choices of individuals. We need to know it and how out of control the Fed has become. Think of this. From 2007, 2010, the Federal Reserve Board lent $16 trillion, more than the entire national debt, $16 trillion. It was lending it out to McDonald's and General Electric and foreign banks and everything under the sun, $16 trillion in trying to so-called bail out the irresponsible companies that had overspent and miscalculated in their economic forecast instead of just letting the people, you or me, overspend or whatever. You know, we either have to pay our debts or get out of business. We don't have the government to come buy up our securities or lend us money out of a precarious situation. We need to tighten up our belt and practice frugality until we're into a profit-making situation. But with all this $16 trillion, it artificially, slowed up the return to a normal, healthy economy. And one of the things that we're disinclined to believe as a people, maybe it's because we're Americans or maybe we're humans, is that it's the natural course of a healthy economy to have peaks and valleys, that economics is guessing about the future, and you're not going to guess it right all the time. You're going to guess wrong some of the time. You know, sometimes you mean Steve Jobs ran over the cliff in some cases and became fabulously wealthy in others. It's trial and error out there. And so it's wrong to think that there's something inherently defective in an economy because it experiences a downturn. No, that's going to happen in life in general. But the government runs in and says, anytime there's a downturn, there's something wrong. We try to fix it. And in trying to fix it, we make it worse. And the Federal Reserve System is the perfect example of that.
And Mr. Fine, carrying along with what you're talking about before we jump topics, you're mentioning the financial bubbles and the bailouts. Now, one of the things that Ron Paul really rose to prominence in the last 5 years is over these bailouts and his objection to them. Or he was actually called the bubble bursting in a lot of cases, the housing bubble and the financial bubbles and the derivatives bubbles. Now, he was really opposed to the bailouts. And just to clarify his position so people who aren't familiar with it, could you explain a little bit about how Ron Paul, as president, would have handled the collapse of these large banking institutions? Would he have said, let's break them up and allow the free market to gobble up what's valuable and just let the rest of it rot because it's worthless?
Well, I don't know whether, the assets don't rot. They just get bought up, and they may be bought up at discount prices. You know, that's not true. It's going to be true of auto plants. It's true of a whole lot of things.
Uh-huh.
Values of assets go up and down. Picasso paintings, maybe some people buy it one day for $60 million and next day for $40. And so it's not like real economic assets disappear. But let's go back and look at one situation, which I think was handled appropriately. That was Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers is one of these big mega banks. Investment banks, and it did go bankrupt. Now, does anyone try to suggest that, my gosh, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, the whole world economy fell apart? No, I mean, it hardly even makes the news anymore. So that when a company, like any individual, overspends and can't pay, it goes into bankruptcy. Other companies will buy up its assets, maybe at a discount price, but the assets don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Paul voted against TARP, voted against the stimulus package, which in part has given us indirectly, Solyndra and these other ridiculous efforts that the government to play Steve Jobs, and it does it very badly. And it's not to suggest that he doesn't feel that there may be down clips and that you may need a safety net for those who are involved in the transition. But for the government to get there and try to manipulate and pick and choose and who ought to win and who ought to get bailed out is insane. And we know as well that these decisions are going to be made for political purposes. That's what politicians do. They make political calculations to guide where the money, where the taxes go. They're not sitting there like Platonic guardians picking and choosing in some academic world as to what's in the public interest of the United States. And that's why these decisions are not economically sound. They are politically sound, at least in the short run, for the political people. And that's why we don't then want them entrusted to the government whatsoever.
Mr. Fine, I believe we have another call for you on the line.
Yeah, this is John Corvino, Johnny B. Good, WPKN's own.
Hello, John. You're on the air with Mr. Fine.
I'd like to ask, how could they have bailed out all those banks? And if you or I were going to bankrupt, we'd probably never recover. And some of the banks paid back these loans within a year of they were going to go bust, and they were able to pay back.
Yeah, where did the money come from?
How do you do that when you go bankrupt?
That's a good question. Thanks for your question, John.
I understand. But the fact is, first, if they were able to, there's an assumption that everybody who got the money needed it in order to prevent bankruptcy. I think that assumption is highly dubious. If the government's going to say, in some sense, the government wanted to throw money out to everybody because they thought that would prevent someone from thinking that if you got government money, then you're on the brink and drive away your customer base. So they said, well, if everybody gets the money, then no one looks special and we'll create a run on the bank, if you will. But it's true that huge amounts of money were paid back. But it's not true that they only were paid back because the government lending was what saved them from bankruptcy. You have to question, well, why were they lending it out in the first instance? Everybody's going to scream, well, I'm going to go bankrupt if that'll mean the government will shower them with billions of dollars. Everybody likes to minimize risk, even if it's a tiny risk. And so the government lent out the money. A lot of it was paid back. Not all of it was paid back. But it's in my judgment, it's still a warping of the general economic situation. That if that money never went out, where would it go? It'd mean that fewer taxes would have to be collected, or go back to you because you could even reduce the other revenue sources. So that would have been in the caller's pocket, or in your pocket, or in my pocket to spend or to start a business. It wouldn't be in these other mega banks' pockets. And I think that Ron Paul does believe that we ought to have a ceiling on the size of the banks, because the too big to fail phenomenon is there because of the way the politics works. If you've got a bank that's got a branch in every single district of every member in the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives, they're all going to get together and say, my God, we can't let this bank go under. We'll have unemployment in our district. So these companies are not building and siting their factories and locations based upon economics. They're doing it looking at the political landscape and what will enable them to escape, economic folly. And that's not something that we ought to tolerate.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport. And we're speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a national spokesman for presidential candidate Congressman Ron Paul. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. Give that number a call now, because we're only going to be able to talk with Mr. Fine for another 7 or 8 minutes. That's 203-336-9756.
This is your chance to get involved.
And I want to switch gears a little bit. Now, this is a conversation I've had with a lot of different people when we talk about libertarianism, and one of them is the legalization of drugs. Starting off with marijuana, you know, Ron Paul's been asked specifically which ones would you legalize, and he said, well, we start with marijuana, and then, you know, other ones may follow depending on how, things go. But, I asked people, and they seem to have this fear that, like, well, aren't we all going to turn into drug addicts if that happens? And, you know, they point to, you know, countries overseas where they're just basically narco states, or in South America where it's readily gotten. But, you know, and I argue that it's, you can get it now, whether you want, if you wanted it, you can get it. And, you know, if it's in you to be an addict, that's the libertarian viewpoint, that you have to take care of yourself. You have to assume some responsibility.
Yeah, what is Congressman Paul's view on the legalization of drugs or the success of the drug war?
Well, certainly the federal drug war is ridiculous. You know, we spent $1 trillion and we're no further towards the so-called the diminishing use of drugs than we were before we spent $1 trillion. And you surely get that the federal government should be out of this exercise and enterprise. It's at best, it's a state issue. States can decide on their own and their people whether they want to authorize it or not. But if you look at the larger issue, I do not believe that when we repealed Prohibition Amendment in 1933, it made us all alcoholics. Now, we do have alcoholism. We had alcoholism before Prohibition. We had alcoholism during Prohibition. We had alcoholism after Prohibition. And it's the kind of issue that that the law has a difficult time dealing with directly. Some things are more correctly addressed through cultural stigmas and ostracism than by putting people in jail of one sort or another. But we did try this with a constitutional amendment, try and regulate private morals with regard to alcoholism, and it was a total and complete failure. And I think that we ought not to try to believe that we can do things through the law when the result is we end up creating or encouraging, you know, drug markets and law violations that address conduct that is not antisocial. We obviously, whether or not you have drug legalization, just like we don't prohibit alcohol, it's still a crime to commit drunk driving offenses. And so any actual antisocial conduct would still be prohibited. So it's not like we're reducing ourselves to the law of the jungle and saying, oh, anybody can do whatever they want. No, You've got to conduct your way, whether or not you're taking drugs or not, that doesn't harm anyone else. Otherwise, the law would address that particular problem.
As we discuss Congressman Paul's positions on issues like the Federal Reserve, intervention in foreign military affairs, it occurs to me that his positions were once a very large, perhaps the mainstream position of the Republican Party. I'm thinking of people like Senator Robert Taft. And somehow, how did it happen that this ends up on the edge of the party and the interventionists and the people who are big promoters of the Fed end up in the center? How did that happen?
Yes, and again, it's my book, The American Empire Before the Fall, that was published by Campaign for Liberty, that really traces this, and it's something that transcends really just party lines. It's what I call the psychology of empire, desire to control for the sake of control, and that leads to an ever-growing size of the federal government. In some sense, it accelerated with the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991, because then there was nobody to check our frolics abroad that display an enormous amount of arrogance, captured in part with a misunderstanding of what American exceptionalism is. American exceptionalism was recognizing that we got the DNA as everybody else, so we need checks and balances in order to restrain our appetites and our are the worst angels of our nature from leading us to try to control other people. That was the exceptional wisdom and insight, is that we are going to be subject to the temptations of everybody else, not that we were somehow born all saintly without any vices or sins. But that attitude, I think that misuse of American exceptionalism to think, well, the government and we are so smart, we can cure all ills of mankind, we need to make the world in our image, is something that has come with the growth of empire that's transcended both Democratic or Republican parties. And what Ron Paul is saying, I mean, this would have been totally innocuous. You know, if he was saying this in 1820, 1821, really up until the Mexican-American War, where we began our empire mentality with manifest destiny as the new creed. And it's just stunning that it's viewed as somehow non-mainstream when nothing could be more at the heart of our constitutional philosophy. I repeat, that makes the individual and individual liberty the center of our solar system, not big government and going abroad. And that has been totally turned on its head as we became, you know, a so-called super military power. Yeah. How do we fight that? Well, it's trying to get ourselves back to that philosophical framework of George Washington, James Madison, John Quincy Adams. The glory of our republic is liberty and not domination.
Yeah, and exactly. Keeping with that point, you know, the absurdity of like the TSA and how they're just training a next generation of people just to be subservient and, you know, like cattle walking through this microwave scanner, you know, getting radiated and just completely submitting to these searches. I've personally talked to people around the country. You know, I'm on a trip to Ohio. I was talking to somebody and he has three little kids and they went on a trip and he was like, you know, if it keeps me safe, I don't care. I'll just take all my clothes off. They can do whatever they want to me. And, you know, he's like pushing his kids through the X-ray scanners and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, and Ken, you always say that phrase, you know, take my freedoms. I'm not using them, right?
That's right. I wasn't using them.
And it's like, what kind of a country are we creating here where we feel so dependent and helpless? You know, no one is able to just like pick themselves up and recover. You know, we need the government to just like look over our back at every turn. Although, you know, look, the TSA is now expanding to proms and they're going to be in the mall and on highways, you know, just random checks whenever they want. I mean, isn't this exactly what the American Revolution was about?
Absolutely. The American Revolution was about the right to be left alone. The first protest, the spark, was the revolt against the British writs of assistance that empowered every petty officer to come rummage through your home searching for some kind of contraband goods. That was the spark. And what you've pointed to is really a cultural degradation, if you will, of the United States, where we've gone to people who want to be vassals to people who refuse to be vassals, and people who will create any sacrifice of their freedom if you promise them even the tiniest infinitesimal increment of safety. Everything gets subordinated to safety, even your own desire to be free and to make choices. And the fact is the TSA has had all the billions of searches. They've come up with not a single terrorist throughout.
In fact, they fail more often.
They'll say, well, that was because we frightened them off, because we're searching grandmothers and kids who are 5 years old. But that seems to me utterly ridiculous. But in any event, the more important point that you're making is that when you have a mentality, a philosophical framework that tries to reduce life to a risk-free existence, there's no stopping point then at what kind of incursions and encroachments on liberty you'll undertake if it's risk-free. Because you can always reduce the risk a little bit more.
Yeah, Mr. Fine,
going out in advance, your defense perimeter is not 1,000 miles, then it's 8,000 miles, and then even the slightest evidence of an aberration.
Mr. Fine, I'm going to have to cut you off there.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Mr. Bruce Fine, who's the spokesman for presidential candidate Ron Paul today. You're listening to In Context on WPKN. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Fine. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for a wonderful audience. I really appreciate this opportunity to participate in a great democratic process.
It's great. Thank you so much.
And thank you, all those listeners who participated in the program. We'll be here again next Monday at noon with another call-in show with an interesting topic, and we'll want you to participate in the show. And my name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero, and behind the boards, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. And we'll see you next week, WPKN.
Take it easy.
See you, everybody.